And I forgot how much comedy was in this one with all the monsters in part 10. And it was the human monsters. It wasn't Doppelcooper. It wasn't Red. It wasn't any of the Lodge types. It was the human ones. It was Richard Horn and Steven, even Chad. We even saw Ben's old nature creeping through a crack in his facade when Sylvia gave him the bad news and then he asks Beverly out. And sure, we get to see the hearts of the Mitchums. They had some compassion in them, even though they're quote-unquote monsters. But the other big bad types were so disgusting, that's all I was left with feeling. And why else I think it has to do with monsters is that the most monstrous event that happened in the original Twin Peaks, Maddie's murder, was followed by a song by Julie Cruz called The World Spins. And it had the arpeggio that basically goes doo 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 doo, and so does this song at the end of part 10. Now, I'm not really sure what to make of it, why they wanted to put this song at the end of all this violence, basically. But I think there is a pattern to it. And one of the things I find most interesting is that The World Spins is all about stay. You know, please won't you stay. I can't remember any of the other words right now. But, you know, it's all about this pleading question. Like, will you be here? Will you stay? And whereas this new one, you know, it has auto-tune in it. People have been talking about that. It seems like it's very structured. And this one is all about there are no stars. So we are in a really terrible place in Twin Peaks right now, and all the comedy that you can throw at it isn't going to make you forget it. Take care, Eagle Scouts. That's all I got this week. Woof.
Oh, excellent.
I believe the song he's referring to goes dun 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 da 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 da.
Yeah, I didn't catch the auto-tune the first time I heard the No Stars song, and then I was watching it before we podcasted today, and I was listening, and I think I could hear a little bit of it when she holds a note for a while, but it didn't seem overt. But it's not like I can tell these things out. I mean, the auto-tune I've been able to pick up on in other songs is real obvious, typically. Mm-hmm.
I think auto-tune is becoming a catch-all for anything that's been modulated one way or another in the studio. I think there's always been corrections, and now auto-tune has kind of become like a generic term. Like when you're going to drink a soda, you don't say you're going to have a soda. You're like, get me a Coke, even though it might be any number of different sodas. You
see what I'm saying? Depending on where you're at.
Yeah, or pop. But like, I think auto-tune is more specific, and that's something that it's...
You have a general application of auto-tune where, like, if you got pitch correction, it's more of, like, a localized application.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely... I mean, I think artists are probably guilty of using that a lot. So I didn't hear it personally, but I only heard... I heard the song four times, but I didn't hear it going into it because it's... Auto-tune sticks out because it becomes displeasing to the ear, for me, anyway, as a music fan, because I feel like it's out of place. It's something that's not supposed to be there, and your ear picks up on it. This just sounded pretty. So if it is auto-tune, it's used correctly, I guess, is all we can really say for it. But you're right, though. There's not a whole lot to celebrate comedy-wise in this episode. It's pretty much a downer. You know, there was a lot of optimism coming out of the last episode, and now it didn't really get picked up on in this episode. So hopefully the next one we can get back on track.
You know, I liked how you brought up the song that played after Maddie's death, The World Spins, and comparing it to this song, because especially with the Rebecca Del Rio and David Lynch song being called No Stars, it's like Darkest Before Dawn. We've really got the sense that something's about to happen after this episode. Of course, we felt that before, but I think we're correct this time. Knock on wood.
If that's the case, No Stars would be appropriate, you know, because it's just full dark. No stars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then so then we get the dawn has to be around the corner at some point. Because if it isn't, we just barrel to the very end of the season and we don't get any resolution, no lightness, no triumph of the good in the world. And I just don't think that's what's in store for us.
It would be pretty amazing if it was, though.
It would be something. Yeah, it would definitely be something.
And then it would be a European TV show.
Thanks, John Bernardi.
Yes, thank you, man. Welcome back to Sparkwood in 21, everybody. This is a No Ship Network podcast on Twin Peaks. Tonight, we have your feedback for part 10 of The Return. So without further ado, we shall get to it. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
Sometimes we don't pimp ourselves out too much on the iTunes thing reviews, and we didn't this last pod, and we're going to definitely do it this week. We want to start off, first of all, for thanking everybody who lately has put in new reviews. It kind of charges our batteries, you know, gets us really pumped for each time we go on, and I'll bring it up and look. Thank you all so much. You guys listen every week. Do us a favor. Go in there. Put some reviews down. Give us some stars. And then get yourself entered into a contest to win the pieces. And I've got a few made. By the time we get to the last few episodes, I'll have them up on Twitter so you can see them. If we get maybe 10 or 15 more, I might put up an extra one. If we get 10 or 15 more after that, I might put up another one. You know, you guys have been gracious enough to invite me into this. So please let me give you something back just for giving us some iTunes reviews. So get in there.
Cool. Thanks, Paul.
Call it Paul's Missing Pieces.
Right? That's good.
Okay, so the first piece of feedback, we're actually going to read from the TV Time app. And like we said, last recap podcast, Steve is now on the TV Time app as No Ship Steve. Paul's also on there. You're just Paul at noshipnet.net, right?
Yes.
And exactly. I'm also on there, and I'm Empath. And and we're all following each other, so that's an easy way to find us. And this is Kent. And Kent wrote to us on the TV Time app last time, and I had shared it, and he had talked about the Jungian shadow. And at first, I want to comment on that because I've been thinking about it again, and I actually read a little bit more about the Jungian shadow. Carl Jung had said that everyone has a shadow, regardless of their accomplishments, talents, looks, etc. It is one of many archetypes we are born with. However, it differs from all the other archetypes because the other archetypes affect how you see the world. The shadow determines how you see yourself.
Oh, wow.
So if Mr. C is Cooper's shadow, and everybody has one. So Cooper was like the pinnacle of human being that a lot of us would like to be. And Steve and I had talked about this early on in Sparkwood in 21. Mm-hmm. How much we admired Cooper as an individual. But, you know, as you get to know Cooper, you start to learn some things. And specifically, when you learn about what happened with Carolyn Earle and Wyndham Earle and the infidelity that happened there. And I think that actually makes more sense to me about him facing her in the lodge now, and then his shadow is released after that. And the shadow is how he views himself. And I just wanted to kind of throw that into the conversation that started last week with our feedback podcast when Kent wrote in, and just add to it. And if anybody else wants to write any more about thinking about that in those terms, that's all I've got.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
That's probably where all the self-criticism in the world comes from, if you're looking at it from that point of view. For everybody looks at themselves differently, or the way that they look at themselves, rather. Everybody's just so hypercritical. I mean, do you really meet that many people who are just like, oh, I'm great, I'm fabulous, and who really mean it?
Yeah.
So
I've only actually known one person to really think highly of themselves. It was really bizarre because it did not match up at all.
It never does. You know, people who just go around thinking that they're just the greatest in the world, it's kind of like they're the easiest ones to find fault with because, I don't know, maybe just because it irritates you that they think that way. But it's interesting to have a psychological explanation for it.
Yeah.
Because I also think the shadow is that voice in your head. I've been listening to Amy Poehler's book, Yes, Please, and she brings up the voice a lot that she calls it the demon that develops. And she actually has Kathleen Turner as the demon voice, which is
awesome.
Because she's got a really deep, gravelly voice, and it's almost like Reagan from The Exorcist. So it suits it. But she talks about how that voice, when it first arises in your youth, especially like when you're going through puberty and all that stuff, and it starts to criticize you, and how you can never get rid of it. So I think that voice is the same thing as the shadow. And so if you think about that, and you look at Mr. C and how Cooper viewed himself, that's maybe that's why he strived to be so good and better. I don't know. You guys had anything else to say about that?
So you think that Mr. C is what Cooper sees himself as?
If they're going strictly in from what Carl Jung defined the shadow as, yes.
Damn, that would suck. to be as good as he is. But
on his
you,
bad days. I mean, it's like that voice.
With the infidelity and everything. Yeah, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And so he felt so guilty about that, and that just compounded things. But, you know, your shadow starts for other reasons. And plus, like, when you read his book, The My Life, My Tapes, it's there mm-hmm. was other.
And it makes sense on why Mr. C is so methodical at what he does, too, instead of being the opposite, where you think he would be, like, you know, going crazy and having partying and stuff. He's kind of, like, cooping that aspect that he's straightforward and methodical on the mission that he's on.
Being really disorganized and stuff. Yeah, that would be exactly. Like, how you would think he might be, just have a really cluttered bedroom.
Yeah.
Ah, there's exactly. shit everywhere. Don't worry about it. Well, it would provide an ample explanation as to why Coop is the way he is, and he tries to stay on the straight and narrow, because maybe you could look at it as him running from past mistakes, but you could also see it as if he looks in the mirror and sees that, you know, mm-hmm. and then you're just like, gee, that would be motivation to try to be really good.
It's a cool theory and aspect of it that's awesome.
And you know, the reason why Kent brought this up in the first place is because he listened to an interview with Mark Frost, and at the end of the interview, Mark Frost referred to himself as a Jungian, and so the doppelganger has been referred to as the shadow self in Twin Peaks before. The recent piece of feedback that we got from Kent, he says, "I'm sold on Steve's Gordon Cole snap prediction. Literally snapping him out of it. I'd love to know how you all watch the show. Do you have a ritual? Do you watch it together? Do you talk all the way through it, or are you intensely focused? Do you watch it twice in a row?"
Go ahead.
For me, I wait until Monday. You know, I usually Sundays are really busy days, so I DVR it. And then Monday, right when I get home from work, I watch it the first time. And I try and squeeze in a second time that evening before I go to bed. And then Tuesday when we record, I watch it the third time right before we go into the pod, just to kind of like suss out a little bit more information. Because I feel like I've always got to, like, I want to really try and bring my A game, you know?
Well, we play the song Push It before it comes on.
Salt and Pepper. Yeah. Try that next week. Just right before you watch it, just play the song Push It by Salt and Pepper.
And I dance Sweet. Around the house to it, and it's awesome.
It gets you okay. pumped up. Yeah. And then so we watch it on our Fire Stick app, and then sometimes we have cherry pie and decaf coffee right before we start it. You know, it's a little bit late for regular coffee, but we definitely don't talk while it's going on.
Except I was talking a lot during part 8.
Part 8, yeah, I had to tell you to be quiet. You were like that person in the theater who talks, you know, like looking at their cell
phone.
Well,
that one was a bit crazy. I wish I'd had someone to talk to during that one myself, and so I understand completely.
But yeah, usually we stay quiet, and then at the end we start our discussions and we start to formulate mm-hmm. how we're going to approach the themes and the ideas that have been presented in that particular part and how it's going to figure into what we say on the podcast and stuff like that. But we're not really talkers with TV shows because we like to absorb everything. Mm-hmm. And so other than that, that's really all the ritual we have. We have salt and pepper, and then we have maybe cherry pie and decaf coffee.
And then we watch it again Monday nights, and that's when we write the recap. And then I try to get another watch in, which usually I'm successful before the recording, because I like to watch as a fan, write the recap, which is a very focused, halting process, and then watch it again so I can let it all coalesce. And then I like to watch it again before we do feedback, which is not always possible because I'm also editing podcasts throughout the week. And then we have Steve's mom over for dinner typically every Thursday night. So tonight I was able to watch it because we had a change of plans. But yep.
Okay, wait. So y'all were serious about salt and pepper?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I will definitely do it then. That's awesome.
It gets you jazzed up. Funny. It sounds incongruous, and you might
like
be able to
pepper,
find
so we're good.
A different song that you like better for that. And there's definitely songs I like better, but that song really holds
yeah,
up.
Yeah, I love that song.
Yeah, you know? I mean, oh, it's yeah. from the we're late good. 80s, but it just it, or mm-hmm. mid 80s really, but it's still
so it's push it. 80s? It's from,
yeah, it's
I
80s.
I thought it was early 90s. No?
I was in the fourth grade.
So. I will go with 87.
Yeah,
I'll
money go with
on
that because I remember hearing it in the rinks. You're right. You're right.
But yeah.
I will definitely push it right before I watch it. I like it.
Nothing to do with Twin Peaks, nothing to do with the themes and motifs, but it's just a good song.
Although now I imagine y'all in your socks dancing around the house, but that's just me. It's good, though. It's good.
All right. Thank you, Kent.
Thanks, Kent.
Hopefully we yeah. answered that.
Thank you.
And Kent, what let us know what your ritual is. And anybody else wants to write in and let us know what their ritual is, we'll share it.
Yeah, that'd be a cool thing to start. Like, to tell us just a little quick sentence about your ritual when you throw in some feedback.
Yeah, good idea. All right, so first up, we've got 3 commenting on the previous episode. First one is from Nico, and I failed to include it in our feedback last week, and I'm so sorry. I wrote to him and I apologize. I went to go swimming at the pool, and I was in mid-lap, and I stopped, and I was like, I realized I did not have Nico's letter in our podcast.
So,
so I went straight home and wrote him and said, I'm sorry.
Just so you know, Nico Suave, we are sorry about that.
Nico Suave. And he says, hello, no ship. Warning, a rambling barf of thoughts coming up in a bona fide puking experiment fashion. First off, I really loved your theory about Mike's lodge body. Maybe he wasn't Bob's initial host, but the most essential one then. It's logical and fucked up, and I love it. I think it'll quench my obsession for the time being. Thanks. Blasted. In my previous letter, when I fiddled with the opening scene of part one, I forgot to close on the most pivotal point I originally had. After listening to the chirping or whatever, the artist formerly known as the Giant says to Cooper, it is in our house now. The rest cannot be said aloud now. Yikes. So weeks ago, I actually didn't have much direction from there. It painted a faint hypothetical parallel to the arms description of his home. Now where he lives is, according to all clues gathered, the waiting room of the Black Lodge, and suspecting that the black and white place is the White Lodge is now there also. Whatever it is, the barflings, the fairy bugs, the owls. Oh, and it just came to me that in Twin Peaks currently, the strange sound is witnessed in a large house made of wood. Oh, and used to be frequently visited by the Giant. Yeah, because he was the
elderly waiter's avatar, yep. Right?
Mm-hmm. The elderly bellhop or whatever.
Yeah, I guess he wasn't a waiter, but he did bring the milk.
That milk will cool on you. Speaking of which, I think it's a nice touch that in several establishing shots of the Great Northern, the very original footage from the 90s is used. I'm convinced of it. The quality cannot be imitated, and it delivers the same mood, which was some of the moodiest of the original show. This brings us to part 9. I absolutely love the episode and will confirm that it is the Twin Peaksiest episode of The Return so far. A lot could be said, and I'm sure will be. I'll share what popped up the most for me. Obviously, what made this episode so Twin Peaksy was the heavy involvement of Twin Peaks, but moreover, it was the achieved mood. It was present all around. Even the Bob Coop and Buckhorn moments. It culminated in the "this is the chair" scene. Honestly, I can't fully describe what it is. Usually, it's present in scenes that have very heavy lore involvement in some form, as it is in this one. Everything that happens and the performances include 100% potential of sliding into full-on camp, but the thing always magically manages to stay on the crest of the wave. Everyone in the scene sells this as a true Twin Peaks moment. Icing on the cake in these, if not actually the essence, is the tone-setting music. Appropriately, the chair scene is accompanied with a superb new Battle Lamenti track. When Mrs. Briggs invites the boys to have that coffee, the catharsis tears me up. Absolutely stunning. I can't wait for that new Battle Lamenti score to come out. The song played during the Birth of Laura scene in the White Lodge, assumably of Angelo's writing, is also breathtakingly beautiful. Another compelling scene in a similar vein is Bill Hastings' questioning, where we also get a lion's share of information and confirmation that is generously included in this part. Matthew Lillard gives a polarizing yet to me stunning performance of the more further breaking down Hastings. He definitely suits the heightened emotionality that David Lynch fancies in his work, with some moments really got me choked up and uncomfortable. The lore dump that we get here is so thick and layered that just mentioning it will be sufficient for now, though I do expect all that is envisioned before us to be brought to light in full form at some point, or I will be admittedly disappointed. Now to some smaller remarks. As a lighter but almost as crucial mood setter, we finally see a good Lucy and Andy moment. So far, they have come out as rather lackluster, especially on a rewatch, but their silly exchange about the chair, wink wink, genuinely works. Especially Kimmy Robertson delivers in the scene's sweet conclusion. We see 2 waiting rooms in this episode, which is telling. First one, at the Las Vegas Police Department, where Dougie Coop is basically bombarded with sobering material. That's good. Oh, And somehow the detectives Fusco and their quirkiness have snuck up to become a prominent part of the Twin Peaks cast, with help of the assumably Badalamenti's new cool jazz track. I didn't buy into it at first, but on second watch, with the whole ridiculous Ike the Spike episode, I took them into the family. So yeah, the second waiting room is presented at Buckhorn Morgue, at the Buckhorn Morgue, Gordon Cole hilariously stating that aloud. In general, it was very fulfilling seeing this much of Gordon and his bunch. We witness an essential event there, too, when Diane receives an SMS from no other than Doppel Dale. We don't really know what this means now, but it is most definitely foreboding. Doppel Dale, I don't think we can call him Bob Coop anymore, can we? Performed his wicked deeds, presumably at the farm, considering the sleeping farmers at the back. He is patched up by the misfit couple played by Tim Roth and Jennifer Lee, who just have a blast with it. Double D also initiates a hit on the Yankton Warden and gives a mysterious reminder to the Las Vegas dude. At first, I thought it was either to make sure Dougie or Ike the Spike is taken care of, but again, on a second watch, neither option seems so obvious. Spike is apprehended by the law enforcement. The way Double D asks, "Did you do it?" and the dude answers vaguely, "Not yet," just doesn't cover the fumbled assassination of Dougie. Therefore, I believe this points to something else. There's still that archive in Argentina where a black box shrunk into a little marble and there's Philip Jeffries. There's still a whole lot. Oh, and as we tragically see Johnny Horn run fiercely into a drywall and get electrocuted in the process, we are slowly closing in on a certain long-awaited person, hinted at with a pair of red shoes walking by. I'll halt the train of thought here for now, loving the show, enjoying the podcast, and waiting for your insights concerning the latest installment as always. Be seeing you, Nico, from another place. You know, we've talked a lot about people dreaming and stuff like that, and then with like Nico mentioning it here about how we're getting closer to the person who we originally saw wearing those red shoes, which would be Audrey Horn. Maybe she's the one dreaming everything, if Joel Bacco is correct to that she is still in a coma, and that's why she would be dreaming around red shoes, among other things. Just putting that out there too.
So what happens if this is all just a dream? How far do we take it, and what do we actually get left with at the end of the series? I mean, we've talked lots of anger. We've as a fan community, we've kind of been enamored with this whole idea of this being a dream or an alternate reality.
Only portions of it, and I would think it would be all the Dougie stuff would be the dream stuff, not the Twin Peaks stuff.
Yeah, but too much of it is overspilling into the rest of the world, though.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I think that happened with other characters, even with Laura, that happened.
Mm, true.
Because I think that's where maybe the Tremonts came from. It's possible.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely possible. I would be disappointed. It's too easy of an answer for it to all be just a dream.
Well, what if it's because I think Twin Peaks is not a dream. What's happening with Richard Horn and everybody there, but what's happening everywhere else is a dream. And there's a lot of like between two worlds. You've got things converging, got acoustic resonance. So there's this idea of pairs and then just Twin Peaks itself. I think something's going to happen where it's going to converge or burst or something.
Yeah. What I was trying to say was I don't think that it's going to be very satisfactory for the audience if there is a dream element to it, because it's already been taken well past the halfway point of the episode, or the season rather. So you're going to get to a point like people want the real deal to be there. We want to see what's going on and go, okay, this is actually happening. We can drive the plot forward and the story forward. If we get to a point where we don't feel like that's happening and it's getting closer and closer to the end of the season, people are going to start to get frustrated, because I think you have to have a lot of patience to be a good appreciator of David Lynch's work. But even that patience is going to have limitations. And I'm not there yet. I don't think any of us are there yet, but
yeah,
I do believe that you can get there if you know, okay, let's say it is a dream. Well, when does the dream end and everybody wake up and we go forward? We take that giant step forward into the reality of what's happening, into the daylight, and then go from there.
Well, I'm okay with it as long as there's actually spillover that happens, like this already happened with the key. We got the key that came from the dream world into reality. And then maybe Audrey dreaming about Cooper is what helps him in the long run to come back. Maybe that's key. But Laura is the one, so that doesn't really match up.
So is that saying Mr. C is in the dream also, or just the Dougie stuff?
Because it comes at it from both ends because mm-hmm. Mr. C being outside of the Las Vegas area and aka Dreamland for
is involved with Vegas and everything.
He's involved with Duncan Todd. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. so you have calls coming in from reality into Dreamland that affect what's going on. Then you have actual physical artifacts like the key that are being pushed out of Dreamland into reality. Yeah. So, all right.
I'm still saying Dougie was created by the giant anyway. So I'm still going with that.
Thank you, Nico. And we're going to move on to the next. All right. So up next, we have JT. This is from part 9 again, and this came in after the deadline. So we're reading it now. And JT, and I think they're referring themselves to as JT, as the JT that Ike the Spike was leaving a message for. Hi, guys. Love the program, but I've never written in before. I had a few comments about this week, but thought rather than take up your time, I'd limit myself to one that is probably less likely to be picked up on regarding the idea that what happens in season 2 is a big snark at season 2 of Twin Peaks. I think you're being too harsh. I think it's a mildly snarky but also affectionate callback, not just to season 2, but to one specific scene. In the last episode of season 1, which Lynch and Frost are very much a part of, they throw everything at the wall in a soapy frenzy. We have murders, shootings, the mill fire, etc., 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 and then Cooper gets shot. More cliffhangers than you can shake a stick at. Then when we start back in season 2, episode 1, again Frost/Lynch, at the end of which Coop comes around and someone, maybe Lucy, details the long list of crimes and disasters that have happened. How long was I out, says Coop, and Truman replies, 6 hours. This is what I think Albert's comment is calling back to as he makes this joke just after a long list of weird/violent things that have happened. Lynch and Frost were just as capable of over-the-top soap opera nonsense, which I like as a counterpoint to the weird horror, and I think it's important that people don't credit everything good as Lynch, and sometime Frost, people give him nowhere near enough credit, and everything bad as everyone else. After all, to my knowledge, and I'm happy to be told I'm wrong, Lynch was responsible for a last-minute rewrite that turned Josie into a doorknob, not one of TP's finest moments. And then JT follows up with the actual quote from the scene that he was referring to, and Sheriff Truman says to Lucy, "Lucy, you better bring Agent Cooper up to date." Lucy says, "Leo Johnson was shot. Jacques Renault was strangled. The mill burned. Shelley and Pete got smoke inhalation. Catherine and Josie are missing. Nadine is in a coma from taking sleeping pills." Dale Cooper says, "How long have I been out?" And Sheriff Truman responds, 6 hours.
Okay, point taken on the snarkiness and the harshness aspect of it. I still stand by what I said, though. I think that that line was written for Albert to make a maybe not so subtle commentary on some of the shenanigans that happened in season 2, because I don't want to put myself in the camp that doesn't give Frost enough credit, because I'm not a Frost hater. I'm definitely more of a Lynch appreciator than a Frost appreciator, but that's just how the cookie crumbles on that one. I don't hate season 2 of Twin Peaks. I don't even dislike it. But I do feel that there are some moments that were not worthy of the caliber of storytelling that was on offer in other parts of the series. So to me, it still kind of stands. I don't mean to be harsh about it, and I don't mean to be snarky, but I still think that's where that was going. But that's just my opinion on it.
I think they're just echoing what most people's comments are also. You know, it's not like they're taking a shot. It's also, as a first time, I only watched each season one time, and I let y'all know at the preview podcast that the second season kind of fell short for me. So if the majority of the fans agree, it's kind of like their own way of going, "We get you. We're not knocking it, but we get you." You know, it's kind of like we might have made some missteps, you know, because I think everybody that I've talked to that, which isn't a whole lot of people other than the three of us that did watch Twin Peaks, have agreed with that sentiment, even what I've seen online. So I don't think that they were knocking it too hard or taking too much of a cheap shot. It was just kind of like a nod and a wink to the rest of us that were like, all right, season 2 might not have been up to par to season 1.
And I agree with that. And I personally don't feel bad about holding this opinion, because I've actually been very charitable and spent a good amount of time discussing season 2 on this podcast and taking it seriously and seeing it for what it is, and, you know, kind of giving it just as much of serious consideration as any episode in season 1 and Fire Walk With Me and the way that we're doing it now. So I'm not against season 2. I'm not a hater. Mm-mm. I try to look at Twin Peaks as all of one piece, just with some ups and downs.
I mean, I see what you guys are saying, but I just don't think that it's like good form. So yeah. I just want to think better of Frost and Lynch. That's all.
Okay, heard. So heard. I mean, there's no definitive answer on whether or not it was or
it's
not.
All, it's just our opinions on it.
Yeah. It's all speculation.
Next up, this is the last one that's commenting on part nine, and it's Christine writing in for the first time, and she says, "Hi guys, first time writer, long time listener here. I felt compelled to write about a few things after your episode nine discussion. For a little color on this, I'm in love with this season. Have not yet had one complaint. As Mr. Jackpots might say, were he not catatonic, I'm all in. I think a lot of things can be filled in, not necessarily answered by the secret history. Frost has snuck a ton of little nuggets in there for us. Your last podcast stirred up the memory of three of them for me. The Jerry Horn bit in the woods seems like more than a simple pot high to me. I think he may have been abducted. Wanted to get your thoughts on that. The first time we see him in the woods, he freaks out about his car being stolen. Maybe he was just returned to a different spot in the woods, which is why his car isn't there. All other abductions have had a similar thread in the secret history of Twin Peaks. Margaret, Carl, and the other kid were returned about a mile away from the spot they disappeared. Major Briggs was found nearby, but not in the same exact spot, etc. What if Jerry had a similar experience into another dimension? His foot sounded a bit like the arm in episode 7 when it was telling Coop to squeeze his hand off. Maybe the arm is trying to insert itself into our world. The coordinates are really interesting. We've got known coordinates to a spot near the Black Hills National Forest, courtesy of Bill Hastings and Ruth. Good shout on Heinrich Vogel being Ruth in secret, by the way, Em. I hadn't thought of that. There are also kind of a set of coordinates that Major Briggs leaves for Bobby, 253 yards east of Jackrabbit's palace. This is tied into the secret history of Twin Peaks. Somewhere in the book, and I will try to find it, but I don't have my copy with me. The dossier mentions that there were sightings or openings. I can't remember exactly what they were referenced as in Washington State, South Dakota, and Nevada, and maybe one other place. I'm working from memory. I think this explains why Dougie was planted in Las Vegas. Must be a portal nearby. Christine says, finally, for my last little non sequitur bit of speculation, you were talking about why Fred may have deleted his blog. It's funny I mentioned that article in particular because it's exactly the first thing I wanted to read since we are seeing so much about sound and frequency this season and was gutted that it didn't lead anywhere. Perhaps Fred had been approached by the government. In the secret history of Twin Peaks, the early reporters of these sightings, Kenneth Arnold, Paul something or another, etc., all had visits from Dougie Milford to recant their stories or shut up in general about what they were seeing. I think the FBI of other covert ops branches was honing in. Again, no answers. Just think some of these things fit in nicely, and I think we are going to get a lot of aha moments by thumbing back through that book. I may have to nerd out and label my copy. I can't believe I hadn't done that already. Can you imagine having the return on now without social media or podcasts? I think I'd lose my mind because there's so much to talk about here, but none of my circle watched Twin Peaks or is as obsessed over it as I am. Yes, I definitely need a new circle, just not one in the woods made of sycamore trees. Being able to listen to other conversations / speculation is amazing. I can't imagine watching the show now and only having an alt.twinpeaks.usenet group to sustain me. Thanks as always for a great conversation. Thank you, Christine.
Thanks, Christine.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine not being able to do what we're doing right now to try to figure out all of what's going on in this show. It would just be too much. I mean, I would be completely lost because what would happen is I would watch all of it and then 5 years down the road, I'd pick up a book where somebody explained it and then be like, oh,
right.
But I would have never had anybody to bounce these crazy ideas and theories off of. One of which that you had, which I'm not saying is crazy, but is really cool, is that Jerry might have been abducted. So, I mean, until we see the what anal do you probe. Call it? The burn. Yeah, the anal probe. The burn marks or the stuff,
symbol.
The symbols burned in his flesh somewhere. We won't know for sure, but that's a really good idea. And, you know, I think we mentioned jokingly that that voice saying, I'm not your foot, does sound kind of like the arm at some point. We kind of like messed around with that idea. So I'm glad you're on the same page with that. That would be great if he got abducted. I don't know why they'd pick him, but it's pretty funny.
And we had talked about when he first lost his car that it seemed like he had been picked up and then dropped off somewhere. Like, he woke up like startled where he was or something.
Yeah, so that would make sense then.
Also, I like the idea that the government was already watching this Fred, possibly, that had the site that was connected to Bill Hastings' website, and that this person has been silenced. Whether coercively or agreeably. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in the dossier, they have these nice little chit-chats with people and get them to be quiet. These days, you just get waterboarded or you disappear forever, I suppose. Yeah. They don't give you a chance to be quiet. They just say, all right, you're done. All right, up next is Casey. And Casey says, on the Feedback from Part 9 podcast, I heard a brief question of which year the return takes place in. So I can't really say for sure that the Twin Peaks location is following the same timeline, but in Part 9, we learn that Bill Hastings is being interrogated on September 29th, 2016. He says he's 43, so according to his ID from Part 1, it would be 2016. He also says September 29th when he scribbles his name and date on the picture of Major Briggs, which I admit looks like 920 with a weird squiggle to the side. We also learned that it is September 29th in Twin Peaks when they talk about Jackrabbit Palace. And we know Vegas and Twin Peaks are in the same timeline because the old room key is being mailed back. But years are hard to come by in these two storylines. The insurance forms in Part 6 seem to only have days and months. I couldn't see a year, but I don't have the best equipment for zooming and enhancing, and the casino cameras in Part 5 don't show dates as far as I can tell either. Except that Doppelkoop is in the Buckhorn timeline and is interacting with Duncan Todd in the Vegas timeline, who hires Ike, who, quote, interacts with Dougie, which I admit is a tenuous link. Who knows how doppelgangers deal with time? But evidence is suggesting to me that Twin Peaks, Buckhorn, and Vegas stories are happening concurrently in time. Are they happening in the same timeline and the same reality? I'd like to think so, but I definitely haven't been able to prove it. The continuity weirdness of the secret history keeps the question in the back of my head. Are these the same reality? How did they tie into the reality of the first two seasons, or even the secret history? And if it is September 29th, 2016, hasn't the dossier been found for a few months? Yeah. I love that you can chase an answer down, find an answer, and have it answer practically nothing. Smiley face. Now, that's all great, but that would mean Laura told Coop she'd seen him again in 25 years in 1991 instead of 1989, as I've always assumed. Looking back, we really don't know how long Coop was in the waiting room before Laura told him that. It's also probably safe to say Laura's prediction wasn't a statement that started a timer on one of the artists formerly known as the Giant Alarms. Especially seeing how Doppelkoop escaped in the early morning and he was scheduled to be pulled back in the afternoon. And they seem to measure time by planetary convergences, not trips around the sun. So I think we can say that it is 2016 without stepping on the timeline from Fire Walk With Me or relying on any of the dimensional phase changes that allow for time dilation that we learn about from searching for the zone links. Wow. Yeah. Let's just go with it's 2016. How about that? That's proof enough for me, all of that right there.
Mm-hmm, I'm good. I'm definitely good with
that. I like that. Thank you for doing all that work and figuring that out.
But I have seen a long thread about the debate of the 9/29 versus the 9/20. It's a lot of arguments.
Right. People getting pissed off at each other on the internet. Thanks for your podcast. I really enjoy your insights. And hey, you gave me a detective task that was fun to track down while waiting for part 10. That's one hell of a gift. Awesome. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Wishing your times both strange and wonderful, Casey. P.S. I don't remember which of you caught it, but way to note poor Ike's whiskey troubles. He was not enjoying that even one.
That Evan
one bit. Yeah, he went from Bullet down to Evan Williams. It's a sad state of affairs. Mm-hmm. So, thank you for writing in.
Yes, thank you for writing in. And Casey, I'm curious as to what you think about the time now after part 10. All right, up next we have Daniel. Daniel says, definitely enjoy this episode more than part 9, except for not having any bad Dale. However, did not appreciate the shortened runtime. Rebecca Del Rio's song was beautiful, but I couldn't help but want something else going on at the Roadhouse interspersed with it. Though after last week's gross rash curl, maybe I really don't need to see more local lowlifes. Albert plus Constance having dinner equals triple heart. sense.
Yes, it does.
We now know that Richard Horne is a grandson, and I've gone from 70% sure he was Audrey's son to 99% certain. He is clearly designed to be one of the most awful little shits you've ever seen, with all the most unpopular character traits cherry-picked. They made sure he wasn't even charismatic or cool enough to gain a misaimed fandom in the way another evil but charming dominant type would. Somehow Alex from A Clockwork Orange manages to be more enjoyable. That's true. Before the show aired, all Mark Frost would reveal about its story was that we definitely see a coffee cup thrown out a window. I guess that's that. So Steven is another Leo, albeit the more strung out and less husky Leo from the pilot, rather than the beefed up version from episode one onward. Cooper should have a stab wound from Wyndham Earl and gunshot wound from Josie when the doctor examines him with Janie E. I knew that a sexual encounter was going to be another of those little moments Cooper would need for his awakening. It's a little shallow on Janie E's part, given that he acts like someone suffering from serious brain damage, and there's still her rage over finding out about Jade. But watching Cooper with that big stupid grin while his arms flap up and down was hysterical. Biggest disappointments is the expectations I had built up for this episode due to its title, Laura is the One. I was hoping that it meant Laura was going to be returning to the narrative and we'd start making our way towards whatever Lynch intends the actual emotional core of this show to be, because it doesn't have one yet. Not like Laura and Leland provided for the background of the original series and the foreground of Fire Walk With Me. But all we got was a very bizarre shot of Cole opening his door to footage of Laura crying on Donna's porch with no clues as to why. Have a great week, Daniel. Yes, I rewatched the episode today, and I noticed that there was not a bullet wound or stab wound on Cooper when he was being examined by the doctor.
I have no idea why this is. No explanation for this, no. Except that they had to build him a different body, unless Mr. C has his real body.
See?
That's okay. A good point. That's
so everything's point. Happening in Mr. C's head. We're back to that now.
No. Because Dougie's body was manufactured for Coop to come into. Now that Coop's essence has gone into this and is still essentially manufactured from the giant's golden puke organ or whatever you want to call it, whatever came out of the giant. You know what I'm saying? It makes sense that it's not there. You know what I mean? And I don't think Coop has his real, or Mr. C has his real body, because he left the lodge with his own while Cooper was in the lodge, right? We don't know exactly who has they both could have the same body, just split down the middle like some of those single cell organisms do when they split up. You know what I mean? So I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. I've had pretty nasty scars on my body from the early 90s. I laid a motorcycle down and they have gotten smaller over time. Significantly smaller. So we don't know also how your body reacts to being in the lodge for 25 years on top of it. It's not like he was eating or pooping or anything else. So why not? I mean, he looks like he's in amazing shape. So maybe while being in there, the lodge hooks you up. You know what I mean?
maybe you get an age appropriate redo on your body. Mm-hmm. And that's why the doctor was talking about how your breathing, your lungs, your heartbeat sound wonderful. Your blood pressure is perfect. There's, you know, Janie E is looking at him like he's an Adonis and he's got no scars or anything to show for it. So that would all support the idea that he could get like a redo, like the lodge somehow like goes, okay, well, whatever's happening in your mind is one thing, but when you come back out the other end, you get a clean slate.
And, like magic. You know, I mean, the magic in there has to be doing something for him to survive 25 years, whether it's time shift. I don't know. Maybe, fuck, I don't know. Once we figure out what's going on, hopefully it all makes sense and works out in its own way. That's all I hope for. You know, I don't want to be left with any questions at the very end. Like, well, I'm sure I'm going to be left with some questions.
Oh, it will be wrong. Left with questions.
But I don't want there to be like a BS cliffhanger, like the second one, because unlike y'all, I had to wait 2 whole months for this next season to start. And that was long enough.
Yeah. It was torturous 60 days. It was torture. Crap, believe me.
So, I mean, it's cool. I hope there's payoff on all of our theories. You know what I mean? So it's such a cool show that we can have two completely different angles halfway through the season. You know, it's fantastic. And I mean, I wish I could say I was looking for bullet holes and stab wounds. I was too busy going, damn, Kyle MacLachlan's got a great body on him. I was a little jealous. I'm not gonna lie. Dude's like 10, 15 years older than me. Would have been, I mean, I'm kind of ashamed of myself.
I had the same facial expression as Janie E the whole time. I was like, ooh, look at that.
He's almost 60.
That couldn't have been his body, right? That was CG. That's why there's no stab wound. The CG guy didn't put it on there, right? Or the body double. I don't know. They just like cut his head off and stuck it on a younger dude. I don't know. I think he needs to be tested for performance-enhancing drugs.
I'd just like to say that I agree with what you're saying about Richard Horne's character not being, there's nothing whatsoever that makes him the least bit relatable, likable. You can't have any empathy for him at all. Mm-mm. And Alex is a good point. I mean, we brought up Clockwork Orange a couple of times over the course of this, of the return. And that's, even Alex had that little bit, even what they did to him later on gave you some sort of sympathy for him. So it's like, and Richard is lacking even that. So,
yeah, well, look at Mr. C has a little bit of a fan base. We all enjoy watching him. I don't like watching him. I just want bad things to happen to him and be done with him.
Yeah, I could watch Mr. C be a villain for hours on end, but I don't like scenes with Richard Horne. They can't get over soon enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just, I just don't like him. So kudos to the actor for really pulling that off. Because it takes, oh, yeah, it takes a measure of doing to really make people like dislike you just when they see your face.
Yes.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel.
All right. Yeah, up thanks. Next, we have Kenny. He says, "Hi guys, just a couple of quick hits I hadn't heard mentioned thus far. One, the consensus seems to be that Laura is the good foil to the evil of Bob. How does that align itself with her rebellious lifestyle? Two, the artist formerly known as the Giant's foreshadowing of the number 253 has now revealed itself in Garland's message, which indicates a portal 253 yards east of Jackrabbit's palace. Three, what is your take on the way Dougie's name is constantly used? He's the only character we have seen with, apart from maybe Leo Johnson, in the original run. Could the overuse of his name be a subconscious mnemonic device to remind people that the peculiar individual they see in front of them is, in fact, the same Dougie they know? We've seen a reference to mnemonics before. Dick Tremaine talks to Lucy about using a mnemonic to recall customers' orders at Horn's department store. Curious to hear what you think. Love the podcast. Thanks." All right, so I guess we should take these one by one. One, the consensus seems to be that Laura is the good foil to evil Bob. How does that align itself with her rebellious lifestyle?
I thought her rebellious lifestyle was a response to Bob.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
But I think he wanted to corrupt her, so it wasn't anything that she'd ever set out to do on her own.
I think it's the core of Laura was always good, and that's what provides the counterbalance to Bob. Her specific actions, you know, you can't be like, okay, well, you did this sexually immoral thing, so we have to scratch that. You can't be a good person anymore. So I'm not saying that's what you're putting forth, but I understand where you see the unevenness of that parallel being there.
Yeah, I remember in her diary, like, she really was into, like, genuinely into doing the Meals on Wheels, and she had massive distaste for Hank. So, yeah, I think, you know, she was naturally aligned towards good.
That's one of the things we covered when we did the book, is like, even Laura, with all of the bad stuff that she's done, doesn't like your ass. You're a shitty person.
Oh, yeah.
So the Giant's foreshadowing on the number 253, it's 253 yards east of Jackrabbit's palace. And Paul and Way also pointed out that in the Secret History of Twin Peaks, there's some illuminating material on page 253, right?
Regarding Jack Parsons, mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what is your take on Dougie being used as a mnemonic? What do you guys think about that?
Well, how is he used as a mnemonic?
Like, I guess what's being said is that everybody is saying his name to try to remind themselves that they're actually talking to Dougie. Like, if they don't say it, like, he's somehow going to disappear from their sense of reality, mm-hmm. is what I'm getting out of that.
Yeah, they say his full name most of the time. There's two, not just Dougie. Isn't it always like Dougie Jones most of the
so.
Time?
I think it's just Dougie. Anthony Sinclair says Douglas Jones, and mm-hmm. and Duncan Todd says Douglas Jones, but
if it's true, that's that's pretty intriguing, because that means that everybody around him realizes that there's something off besides the fact that he acts like he does kind of have brain damage. And they have to keep reminding him themselves that he's there, and they have to keep saying his name, because if they don't, then he might just like fade away.
Kenny's basically saying the fact that Dougie's name is said out loud a lot more often than most other people would say somebody else's name, that it's being used as a mnemonic device as a way to remind themselves that Dougie exists.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Or that
I didn't understand that that statement at first, so now I do.
Huh. I mean, that's a cool way to look at it.
I mean, if I think about it based on what Kenny's saying here, I think he's right, because it does seem like Dougie's name gets said a lot, but I feel like it's because it's Janie E who has to constantly kind of reroute him all the time.
That's true. Dougie, don't touch that. Dougie.
She's like his life GPS. Dougie, no. Thanks for the letter, Kenny. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Kenny.
So this also happened with Leo, he said, also?
Yeah, he's saying that people were doing that with Leo. They he heard Leo's name said out loud a lot.
Huh.
Leo Johnson. But I think there was a lot
That was
lot
more
of,
because he was like a red herring, maybe.
It's possible. Yeah, that's my first instinct to that, because his name was said a lot by Cooper and Truman and everything, because they're talking about they're trying to figure out initials and get to, you know, the bottom of it, and you have the whole...
Plus, Leo was catatonic, too. Leo.
Not till later.
Quit drooling, Leo.
Yeah, Leo. Like Bobby would have said his name a lot, along with Shelley at that point.
Leo! Thank you, Kenny.
Yeah, thanks, Kenny.
All right, up next we have Carl. Carl says, I was surprised, along with everyone else, that episode 10 ran 7 minutes short of an hour. On one hand, one of the advantages of straight-to-streaming television is that episodes can be as long or short as they need to be. On the other hand, doesn't last Sunday's short-run tie mean that we aren't actually getting a full 18-hour movie, as has been hyped, or will other episodes run long to compensate?
Hmm.
My preference, which Frost/Lynch don't care about, of course, would have been to have 7 minutes added of something that would have been, quote, fan service. Were there really no fun, delighted scenes on the cutting room floor that could have been added in? Or did the shift from 9 to 18 episodes mean that all the missing pieces are already in?
Well, I'm sure they have another sweeping scene they could put in for us. So I'll
take
the
end. For a whole 7 minutes this time.
Yes.
Yeah, depending on my mood, I could either just go with them going, okay, this is all we had to give you for the episode. And then when you add on Rebecca Del Rio's song, that shortens the length of actual acting and plot that's in the episode by another, what? 4 minutes. So it's getting shorter and shorter, but maybe I don't need to see another sweeping scene like Paul mentioned.
No.
So it's kind of like sometimes if you don't have that much to give us and this is what fits, just go ahead and, you know, not show it to
Plus,
us.
Plus, isn't the last episode 2 hours long?
That's what I've heard.
Mm-hmm. So that would explain. I bet the one before that has. I bet those last 4 or 5 episodes will be a little longer, possibly, you know, because we're going to have to get a little more information.
Hopefully.
So who knows? I mean, maybe they'll give us some extra love in next week.
Just don't depend on it. It might happen, but don't depend on it.
Thank you, Carl.
Thanks, Carl.
Hot water, Carl.
So up next, we have Bob writing in. All right, that's it. I quit.
Can't do it anymore.
Don't want any contact with Bob. All right, Bob says, hi all, really enjoying the podcast. Not that much to add other than I think the red box of Gordon's is the wire detector that he used on Tammy, as well as noting that the clip of Laura was from the scene where she was begging Donna to her friend, perhaps implying that we shouldn't give up on Diane. Okay, so if that red device is his wire detector, he did not have it close with him when he talked to both Albert and Tammy, so I wonder if that affects anything. So he wasn't detecting if either of them were wearing wires.
Okay.
Obviously, that's important to him for a reason. He kicked Tammy out of a conversation for that. I guess I think what, Bob, what you're saying about Laura and begging Donna to be her friend, her actions show this like sort of pain and trauma, but she can't tell what's really going on. And so Donna was kind of in the position of Gordon Cole in relation to Laura, like Diane is to him right now. That's what I think Bob means by this. So I will see.
So I mean, I guess the implication would be that, I don't know, Laura begging Donna to be her friend, implying that we shouldn't give up on Diane.
I think because Laura showed up and was clearly in pain, but she couldn't tell Donna why. So Donna just still had to kind of ignore all that stuff, but she still followed her later and all of that. So like if you put Gordon in Donna's role and Laura in Diane's role or vice versa or whatever.
Maybe it's like, don't forget about me, you know, keep me in mind because things still need to be figured out. Yeah.
I don't know. But apparently Diane's hugs spoke more volumes than anything else. So I don't know.
You can tell a lot from a person's hug.
I guess. Maybe they just don't like hugs. Fuck.
Just not huggy people.
She used to grab my ass. Now she didn't.
Thank you, Bob.
And, thanks, Bob.
And thanks for not spelling your name all in capital letters. They're all in lowercase just to let us know he's cool and friendly. Up next, we have JT. And JT says, hey, guys, just wanted to – and this is JT now commenting on episode 10. And he says, hey, guys, just wanted to point out that Run Silent, Run Deep is a 1958 submarine film starring Clark Gable. Great episode. Thanks.
Thank you for that. Okay, that makes sense. You. All right.
I haven't seen the movie, so
That is probably where she got that from then. Mm-hmm. Not definitely not an Iron Maiden song. So
and, I'm going to go with Iron Maiden.
And thank you, JT, for that. And up next, we have Nicholas. And Nicholas says, hello, M, Steve, and Paul. Well, we're in the version layer now, according to Candy's weather report. Yeah, sure. I knew what that meant all along. Hell no. I had to look it up and learned, I think, that the correct term inversion layer refers to an atmospheric stratum that traps the temperature, air, and pollutants below it. The tropopause is an inversion layer between the stratosphere up there and the troposphere down here. More in between us in a sec. Then I thought how Candy had sounded dumb talking about things she didn't understand. Then I remembered I hadn't known what it meant, plus was probably being sexist and elitist. Then I remembered that feedbacking about the return is talking about things I don't understand. Then I bashed myself in the head with a remote control.
The best possible of all responses.
When I came to, I thought it unlikely that the version slash inversion thing was unintentional. I started seeing this episode as us being in the version layer, sandwiched between different versions of Cooper, Laura, supernatural forces, and of the show itself. Maybe we have passed through a zone of ultra-high weirdness and greater focus on eerily decentered locales and Coopers. If so, then the last two episodes have been a zone adjacent to another, no doubt still weird and eerie. Version of all these things, that is, as others have long speculated, driving the story towards Twin Peaks and whatever plot convergence and resolution might lie ahead. This movement through three phases of storytelling is how Fire Walk With Me, Lost Highway, and Mulholland Drive were structured. This episode gives clues of a similar structure and coming transition. Candy herself, in the version layer lines, tells us that it's going to be hot and smoggy tomorrow. That immaculate hand wave of hers defies her distress and persists, hearkening back to the previous episode's hand arm movements echoing those that preceded the denouement of the original series. Gordon's drawing. I don't know what the hell that animal is, if it's an animal, but the antlers are to me clearly trees. We know where there are lots of trees, and that hand arm is in the pre-grabbing zone. Is it the arm, the long arm of the law, or both? I'm betting on both. By the way, we may be about to grasp something big in the next phase, and then we will have it, but we still may not know what the hell it is. Rebecca Del Rio's performance. That's what marked slash triggered the transition in Mulholland Drive. She sings that her dream is to go to that place, you know, the one where it all began, which along with the log ladies, now the circle is almost complete. It all comes out now. And even Jerry's, you can't fool me, I've been here before, seems like a not so cryptic signal for many returns to come. Laura's appearance in Gordon's doorway was a mirror image replay of her overwhelmed appearance at Donna's front door in Fire Walk With Me after she saw Leland come out of the house where she had just seen Bob. She was on the cusp of the revelation that moved that story into its final phase. Did you feel like Janie E's morning afterwards to Dougie Coop? I just had to tell you that. Let's get you to work. We're a farewell. We all know the possible ways they might never see each other again, but I felt like the separation was coming as she delivered those lines. Carl Rod's song is all about this kind of separation, even using a middle zone as a reference point. From this valley, they say you are leaving. Non sequiturs. 1. The log lady's interaction with Hawk made me think back to her phoned accompaniment of his hike to Glastonbury Grove. Neither call connected to his search for the missing thing. This dying woman is one of the strongest, most dignified characters on the show, and what we are witnessing seems like apprenticeship. I think she is passing on her wisdom, methods, role, and maybe even log to Hawk. At the same time, her lines here struck me as a counterspell in the woodsman's poem, coming from the person most qualified to deliver one. 2. Laura's appearance replaying her moment on the cusp of an undesirable revelation immediately precedes the undesirable revelation of Diane's apparent betrayal. 3. To finish off all of this hand movement stuff, in epilepsy, there is the phenomenon of the Jacksonian march, where convulsions begin in the hand, head up the arm, and either stop or keep on going before generalizing to half of the entire body by generalizing electrically in the brain. There may be more than metaphor here regarding how and in whom the lodgers exert their effects. Gordon's drawing fits with this too. If we get any further up that arm, we're on the verge of a wholesale breakthrough, though for good or for ill, I don't know. Thanks for bearing with a longer than usual feedback. When this is all over, we feedbackers will think of you guys as the good ones who have been with you. Nick. Let's see. And Nick, thank you so much for your letter. And by the way, don't worry about like when you have to, you know, resend an email with corrections. It actually helps us. So we're totally cool with that because he apologized about this at the beginning. And don't feel like you have to apologize for that. It actually helps us read them better. There was something I want to say. Yeah, he brought up the drawing of Gordon, and I was actually rewatching it today, and it actually, the arm reminds me of when Bob came out of the lodge. You remember you saw his arm first?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So
that would like show how things are kind of like coming through barriers or
We keep getting all of these signs of something that's about to happen, something that's about to happen, and then every week comes and goes and that goddamn thing doesn't happen. It's getting frustrating. It's just getting frustrating to me because I want it so bad. I've wanted it so bad since I've seen this original series, you know, for these things to come. I guess I just have to be patient.
Steve and I actually lived in Boise, Idaho for 3.5 years, and they have problems with the inversion. It actually traps a lot of particulate matter as well as other things under it. If you live in a basin, like people who live in Boise do, and they have to ban wood burning stoves and things like that, and you don't see the sun for a very long time, even up to like 2 months when it happens.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they had one right when we first moved there. It was pretty cool because I'm not the biggest fan of the sun. But then after about a week or so, you're just like, okay, it'd kind of be cool if these clouds just moved away for a little bit. And then when you do see the sun, you're like, oh, it's not so bad.
Yeah, we actually knew people who had seasonal affective disorder there because of it.
Wow, that's crazy.
I like Nick's idea that the hawk could be being groomed as Margaret's apprentice. And you maybe even get the log or some, it's probably his own version of that. You know, he would have like a cool pocket knife that would have her spirit in it that would talk to him or something like that, I would think. I don't know. I can't see him carrying around a log, but I like the idea that she's passing on skills and talents.
Absolutely.
And sensitivity to him.
He's her grasshopper.
He's her hawk.
Grasshopper.
Grasshopper hawk.
I'll figure it out. Okay. All right. Thank you, Nick. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Nick. Great feedback as always.
Thanks, Nick.
All right. Up next is Tina. Hello, M. Stephen Paul. It's Tina, your friendly neighborhood retired crime scene technician. I didn't have anything to comment on regarding episode 9, which was one of my top favorites so far. I did, however, want to write about this one. Unfortunately, episode 10 is not one of my favorites. I once again had the feeling of running in place, even with a couple of new revelations, which is why I'm giving it a B-. Ooh. I'll apologize, as always, if you've touched on these plot points before, and also apologize for the length of the email, but there's so much to cover. I just hope my thoughts will add to the conversation. I'm also listening to your show as I finish the draft, so I've tweaked my email a bit in response. Albert's got a girlfriend. I love it. Definitely shipping him and Constance. Carl should have called the police. Due to modern awareness and domestic violence issues, many states years ago passed laws so that even if the fight is over when the police arrive, a suspect can still be arrested if the alleged victim shows any type of physical abuse or looks as though she's being intimidated. This came about because most women were too frightened to say anything, and even if law enforcement saw evidence of abuse, police couldn't do anything unless the victim verbally verified it. I don't know what the law is in Washington State might be when it comes to domestic violence, but if Kentucky had had such laws on the books since the 90s, I would think Washington does as well.
That's a good law.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of laws like that. I was under the impression that they had to see something going on.
I wasn't aware of that either. I wonder if very many people are.
Dougie Cooper finally makes it to the doctor. However, I'm not sure what school of medicine this doctor graduated from, unless it was the same as Dr. Nick from The Simpsons. So I'll call him Dr. Nick,
or
too.
Dr. Spichemin.
Yeah, Spichemin. What is that word? Diabetes. Oh, yeah. So in all of Janie E's ramblings, he knows Dougie Coop vanished for several days. I'm assuming, as his family doctor, he would know of Dougie's medical history, including the car accident. Therefore, just so I wouldn't put myself in line for a malpractice suit, I would have said, well, I know his blood pressure, etc. are fine, and I'm thrilled he's lost weight and is healthier, but he disappeared for a few days, has no explanation as to why. I know he has his episodes, but to be on the safe side, I'm going to order a CAT scan to make sure everything's okay in that noggin of his. Did that come up? Nope. Not as far as the dialogue we hear. I'm surprised Janie E didn't demand a CAT scan. Dr. Nick, too, would have been obliged to avoid some future liability. Also, although we couldn't see it due to the camera angle, I thought for sure Dr. Nick, too, was going to mention the bullet wound scar. After nothing was said, I was confused, and it doesn't say much for Dr. Nick, too's attention to detail. Guess he was also overwhelmed by Cooper's buff body.
We all were.
Yeah, we all were. And none of us saw the knife wound or the bullet hole either. So we've already talked about this before, but we'll see what happens. Sonny Jim is going to need therapy in a few years. I felt very uncomfortable knowing that kid heard everything. I also wondered if he'd heard those sounds before. Mm-hmm. I have a sneaking suspicion Janie E. and Dougie haven't had marital relations in a very long time. Well, they did to conceive Sonny Jim. Unless he and his mom, as has been speculated by a few, were somehow manufactured. And whichever of you suggested Janie E. might get pregnant, shut your mouth. Cooper has enough problems. I don't remember who said that. I remember talking about it, but no, it wasn't. Was it?
It was you.
Oh, yeah. I can't read the rest of your letter then. No. Right now, we probably have two murders in addition to the vehicular homicide in Twin Peaks. The shoddy investigation into the child's death is starting to anger me because it seems at a standstill. Considering it's a high-profile case, I would imagine either Sheriff Truman or Hawk, as senior officers, would take lead, possibly even Bobby, but not Chad. I'm guessing the witness Andy should have taken into custody was murdered, although no one has told us one way or the other. The school teacher is likely dead, although we never saw an investigation and no hint was given that her body has been found or that she has been hospitalized. Several forum commentators swear they saw her breathing. Anyway, if Miriam is dead, an autopsy will reveal she died from what was likely blunt force trauma, even if the body is burned.
I did rewatch it today, and you could tell she was breathing, and especially toward her bottom of her back, you can see her body rising and falling.
Well, that's bad news for Richard, because that thing's not going to catch on fire. So, like we talked about, so she's going to, hopefully she lives to talk another day.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
When Miriam first said she'd talk to the police and didn't know why Richard hadn't been arrested yet, I figured she gave witness testimony when the police did a basic canvas of the area to see who saw what during the initial investigation. If she did, why hadn't Richard been arrested or brought in for questioning? I'm sure she felt her declarations would frighten him. I was shaking my head and thinking, lie to him. Don't tell him anything. If he ran over a kid, he won't think twice about killing you. I know this isn't CSI or an Agatha Christie mystery, and I don't want it to be, but I'd like to see some inkling of a real investigation. We get Andy not doing a proper follow-up and Chad breaking federal mail laws. If Twin Peaks law enforcement can't do a proper job, then call the Washington State Police for assistance. I'm beginning to think if we see Audrey, she'll be in a rehabilitation center or a convalescence home. Per commentary on the Lost at the Movies website, it was difficult convincing Sherilyn Fenn to return and that she might not have been happy with things. We don't know if this means the size of the role, script quality, or what. Now another forum commenter said that according to IMDb, Fenn was supposed to be in roughly 8 episodes. This information may have been incorrect, as the IMDb gods have tweaked many of the entries to correct the cast lists and their episode appearances. Fenn's name, as of yesterday, is now non-existent.
Whoa.
Whether this is currently accurate is anyone's guess, but no Audrey is getting as annoying as the Dougie Cooper routine. If the iconic Audrey ends up doing a soap opera-ish catatonic scene, it will disappoint so many fans, myself included. Damn, see, IMDb is notoriously, bad for that kind of stuff. We talked about
people need
before.
To quit going there.
Yeah, it's
well,
kind
I'm
of like
to go there. I want to see this.
The song we hear in the background during Richard's tirade was used in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in conjunction with the drugs to control the patients. That's pretty cool. When I heard what I assumed was Sylvia's security system announcing Richard's arrival and she throws open the front door, I thought her reaction was going to be one of grandmother thrilled to see her bad boy grandson, loving him no matter what he does. So she surprised me. Why open the door at all if the devil is there just to announce go away? Why would you believe saying go away would work? Call 911. Tell them you fear your grandson is going to get violent. You're in fear of your life. Then go get your 9mm or better yet, a double-barreled shotgun and let the son of a bitch have it if he kicked in the door.
Well, but I mean, you just hit the head on the nail a minute ago. The police department in Twin Peaks doesn't seem to be up to par lately, so why make the phone call if nothing's going to happen?
Yeah, I would just shoot him because you're not going to get in trouble for it anyway because they're going to send Deputy Andy or Chad over there and you just be like, hey, I'll tell you what, I'll come down to the station sometime when I can kind of, you know, get it in my date book. How about that?
Yeah, exactly.
Why open the door to this demon and demand he leave when obviously you won't want him there and he's not going to give a damn anyway? Stupid. One commenter wrote that in some families like the Horns, they attempt to keep these troubles within their family unit without involving outsiders such as the cops. This might be the case. However, I wouldn't have opened the door to say, go away, when you already know what he is, and I actually thought Sylvia and Johnny were goners. I figured Richard would think, hell, what's two more going to matter, and kill his grandmother and his uncle. In Ben's office, we briefly saw the lamp again. I don't remember hearing the humming.
Okay.
That's a good point. I don't remember it either.
Wasn't that in her office and not his?
Beverly's office?
Yeah, isn't it in Beverly's office that she's hearing it, not in his office? Well, she swore it was hers office.
Does she have an office?
I don't know. Yeah. Does she? Does she?
She's outside of his office. Every secretary has her own area. That's why I thought, because the room that they're walking in seems a lot smaller than his huge office. You know what I mean? Because they're walking from corner to corner in like a few steps. His office is massive. Remember he had the Civil War thing there? It's a big office he's got.
For some reason, I was convinced it was his office. I'm about to verify this, but...
Okay, it's cool.
I don't know now.
Now I can't.
At the time when we watched it convinced it was his office, but I don't know now. Yeah.
Because they always show long shots of his office. You know what I mean? Like you see the big, giant, you know, that thing is just unreasonably big.
It's like a whole suite. It's massive.
She goes on to say, I'm starting to believe Jerry's adventure is more involved than him just being high, as many continue to think. The other week, M mentioned something about fairies or the fae, which got my anthropology friend and me thinking. We both believe Jerry is trapped in an in-between, with part of his body, his foot, still caught in a fairy-type circle he disturbed. My friend doesn't believe that the usual fairy lore stretches to the Pacific Northwest, but we know the woods around Twin Peaks are suspicious. I want to conclude with Gordon's doodle or drawing, which has so many puzzled. In discussing episode 10 with my anthropology friend, I introduced Twin Peaks to last year, and who is now pretty well versed in the series. We were emailing about Gordon's drawing and a possible meaning as to the animal figure and what appears to be a hand off to the side. She sent me some interesting links I wish to share. She sent me some interesting links that I wanted to share, and this one is on Native American lore, and we're going to have this link in the show notes so you guys can go and check it out.
All right. So I went to IMDb, and instead of scrolling all the way down looking at the full cast and crew for Twin Peaks 2017, I went to Charlene Fenn's IMDb page, and Twin Peaks is not listed.
Oh, wow.
And just to verify or to cross-check, I looked at Cheryl Lee, and hers does list Twin Peaks, but Charlene Fenn's does not.
Interesting.
Shenanigans. I'm claiming shenanigans.
Okay, so, check these out. We have a lot of feedback to get to tonight, so this stuff is interesting, but we're not going to go into it because we're going to stick with the thoughts that are more specifically about, you know, what's actually going on in the show and what you guys think about it. And Tina finishes off. She says, okay, this email is already long enough, so I won't get into the Diane issue or Mr. C in the glass box. Maybe save that for next time? Because that is interesting. Like, who's the bald guy? Anyway, thanks again for a great podcast and looking forward to more. Take care, Tina.
Thank you, Tina.
Thank you, Tina.
Thank you.
All right, up next we have Rachel, and she says, hello, my three favorite podcasters.
Aww.
Rachel has started watching Vikings.
So cool.
So she can listen to us. So awesome. You'll enjoy it. It's a fun show. And Rachel says, this was by far the funniest and most disturbing episode so far. The switch from humor to sheer violence was so starkly abrupt, I would be laughing out loud 1 minute, then feeling completely upset and distressed the next. There was a lot of violence against women in this episode, and those scenes were all so raw and visceral, they really, really disturbed the hell out of me. This may be one reason why Laura showed up in a vision to Gordon. Maybe this episode is partly a metaphor for the duality of her life. Can I just say I fucking hate Richard Horn? I hope that little bastard dies soon. I'm now pretty much completely convinced he's the offspring of Audrey and Evil Coop, which brings up all kinds of horrible rape/sexual assault scenarios I'd rather not think about. This is so much more disturbing when juxtaposed with the innocent, sweet nature of their relationship in the previous two seasons. I like the idea that Diane is involved in her own investigation regarding Mr. C. The burning questions I want answered are, why is she so angry with the FBI, and what happened during her last meeting with Cooper/Mr. C? I really bought into her pain and simmering anger as she was questioning Mr. C, and I don't think she's putting on a front about that. I know there's been some speculation about Albert, that Albert is shady, but I haven't picked up on any of that, or more likely haven't wanted to pick up on that. I love his character so much. I'm keeping these blinders on until something smacks me in the face. And Em, I agree with you. I didn't think Gordon and Tammy were being condescending when they were watching Albert and Constance over dinner. I think they were being genuine. Boom. Dr. Jacoby's rant had me rolling. I work for the government, on the state level, and feel like I'm getting fucked on a daily basis. The bureaucratic bullshit is maddening, and I sure as shit couldn't handle it on the federal level like Cooper did. To quote Carl Rod, it's a fucking nightmare. The end song was so hauntingly beautiful, it reminded me a lot of Julie Cruz's song The World Spins, which played in the Roadhouse in the episode when Laura's killer was finally and unfortunately revealed. For some reason, it also made me extremely sentimental for Cooper, and I now believe he will come back. Otherwise, what else are we building towards? There, I've refuted my own original conclusion. I really don't have any theories, as that topic is covered by people much more knowledgeable and astute. While they're able to draw parallels in metaphysics and symbolism and semantics, I'm just over here like, Cooper likes coffee. I think my viewing is based more on how the episode and certain scenes make me feel, rather than connecting the dots. I really enjoy listening to everyone's thoughts, and it makes my viewing of the series so much more richer. And Paul, I really like how you said we shouldn't feel bad about being wrong, because we're all in this boat together, taking this amazing ride. And what an amazing ride it is. Thank goodness I have this forum to talk all this out, and because I don't know anyone who watches or even cares about Twin Peaks. I tried explaining the first few episodes with my coworker, but when I started talking about the arm midget evolving into a tree with an ovary on top, he pretty much quit listening. So if it weren't for your podcast, I'd feel very lonely indeed. Thanks for all you do. Until next week, Rachel.
Awesome. Thank you, Rachel.
Yeah, right. I've actually tormented my coworkers, not intentionally, but it turns out that Twin Peaks is a torment device, or can be.
Oh, I mean, it can torture us. Imagine being taken out of context and just having somebody watch 5 minutes of it and be like, what is this? What the hell's going on?
Yeah, I showed the frog right. bug to one of my coworkers, and she started screeching immediately. She doesn't like frogs or lizards.
So maybe, Rachel, you should try to, you know, talk about the donuts and the pie and the coffee and the quaint town and the homecoming queen, and see if that angle gets people in the door. Because, you know, when you go the arm midget evolving into a tree with an ovary on top, it's you're starting up too high for them. You know, you gotta bring it down to the common denominator level.
And Rachel, you are right to question what else are we building up towards? I think you're right, and that is the answer, and we will see it. I have faith.
It has to be. All right. Up next is Shayna. Shayna says, Dear M. Stephen Paul, hey guys, longtime listener, first time correspondent. I've been enjoying your discussion of Twin Peaks, The Return, but I have to take issue with your assertion that Cooper/Janie E's sex scene can't be rape because he's hard. Just a failure to achieve an erection doesn't mean someone doesn't want to have sex. The fact that someone gets hard or even ejaculates isn't proof that they do want to have sex. In fact, male victims of rape who experience erection and or orgasm because of their assault can be further traumatized by this betrayal by their own body. All that said, I believe that while Cooper did not know what he was in for when Janie E took him to bed, if he had wanted her to stop, he was capable of making that clear, and hopefully if he said no or showed signs of distress, she would have done the right thing. Looking forward to whatever's coming. Shayna, aka Laughing Academy. Hey, you got your own nickname. You gave yourself your own nickname, Laughing Academy. Okay, so, yeah, the subject of this one was A Standing Cock Has No Conscience.
Well, yeah, I mean, we had also said that he would have defended himself, you know. Coop, the essence of Coop is still there, just like when he was attacked, he defended himself. If he didn't want to do this, I think Coop would have stopped it.
Yeah.
You know, he's more than capable.
The erection discussion was kind of a side discussion that we had after we had already kind of decided that this wasn't rape for other reasons. And then, you know, we talked about the discussion, you know, and then I'm only whatever, you know, I said about erections was only based off of my own experience. And then you have to go and bring science into it. But, you know, whatever. No, but that's interesting. I didn't know that. I never heard of that. Actually.
I guess it's hard for you guys to imagine that that's possible. So, but so that's why you said all
right,
that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, as a guy, it's hard to imagine, like, if you're being raped, the idea of getting erection or even having an orgasm seems 100 million miles away. So I don't, yeah, that's just, but, you know, there's.
Well, hopefully I never find out for sure.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a good point. It really is a good point.
Yeah. And then, you know, if
I look at it as two married adults having consensual sex, because I really think he would have stopped if he didn't want it. I mean, he's been in the lodge for 25 years, even as a partial invalid. You're still, you know, I think it was necessary. Now he can think clearly.
He's got the baby batter off the brain.
Exactly. 25 years of backlog. Jeez, he's lucky he's lasted as long, but Coop's the all around, you know, perfect man. So it probably went on forever.
You know, look on his face during, the look on his face after, the fact that he was able to handle himself with Ike the Spike, you know, all of these things add up to where this isn't rape.
Thank you, Shayna.
Yeah, thanks, Shayna.
All right. So up next, we have Duffy. And Duffy has a word association, I think, going on here. Duffy says, Gordon Cole's drawing is the subject. Deer, antlers, buckhorn, hand reaching out from beyond, from another place towards buckhorn. Watch Albert like a hawk. Part four, Albert, Albert, Albert. Gordon knows, Gordon sees. Love, Duffy. And then Duffy sends us another letter saying, also, apologies in advance for Albert. Apologies in advance for Albert. Twice from Golden Cole or David Lynch. Flying Frogs and Welcome to Twin Peaks, An Access Guide to the Town, A Native American Legend, A Woman in a House in the Middle of a Lake, Flying Frogs, A Special Crest, Love, Duffy.
Thank you, Duffy.
Yeah, thank you, Duffy.
Thanks, Duffy. We don't have anything to comment on the word
I don't know what to say about any of that.
These are, I think Duffy's trying to say that these are all clues and possibly code that are pregnant with meaning that we should be maybe focusing on.
I like the antlers, the deer antlers, buckhorn that in his drawing, and watch Albert like hawk would do. But how well versed was Cole in Hawk's actual, you know, sheriffing skills, unless Dale Cooper pulled him aside at some point and says, this guy over here, Hawk, he's the only one who does any work around here. So
up next, we have Nicole. And Nicole says, hi, I'm Steve and Paul, sliding in under the deadline here. Piggybacking on feedback are Nick's thoughts on Candy's reference to being in the version layer and the correct term inversion layer. I found the following word and definition in an old psychoanalytic dictionary and wanted to share. Inversion, the dream's transformation of one thing's into its opposite in order to disguise it. Huh. Loving and hooked on Sparkwood and 21 as much as the actual episodes. Anyone not listening is missing out on a rocking companion to the show. Thank you for bringing your smart perspectives and authentic joy to this creative and fun contribution. It's a real gift to fans of Twin Peaks. Aw, thank you, Nicole.
Right, thank you so much. You should go on iTunes and write all of that. It's perfect. It's the perfect place for it. But so, we appreciate it regardless. Thank you so much.
So, Nicole, are you the other half of Nicholas? Nick and Nick? Got Nick and Nick? Okay, I like that. Inversion, the dream's transformation of one thing's into its opposite in order to disguise it.
Pretty cool stuff.
So if we could apply that to certain characters, you could apply it to Diane, you could apply it to Dougie, obviously. Mr. C, even. Thank you for introducing that new definition for inversion, Nicole. I think this is going to be a word we're going to bring up again and again from this point on.
Yeah, definitely something to chew on, for sure.
All right, next up, we have Kez. Kez says, sorry, this may be a little long, 10 episodes in, and we're getting closer to the end, and closer to, once again, no more Twin Peaks. At the end of season 2, there was the question of whether Ben Horn was Donna's father. What if Richard Horn is the son of Donna and James, not Audrey? Might be how the other Haywoods come in later, and James has a small but important role. Yeah, okay, now I'm no longer 100% about Audrey. Especially because the IMDb also. But anyway, Kez says, possibly Donna's parentage came out, leading to the divorce of Ben and Sylvia. James had gone off on his bike, Donna pregnant with his child, fallen out with her own family, leading to her turning to her real father and her child, then given the Horn name. I struggle with the dark Audrey and the dark Coop having a lighter-haired son. I agree. Dougie and Janie E. I love the scene in the doctor's office. The doctor saying Dougie's health change is remarkable. Janie E. so mesmerized by Doug's physique that she repeats remarkable in the same way her husband has been repeating mindlessly the last words said to him. Watching the episodes at 4 in the morning, Dr. Amp looked really sinister with his military hat and lightning bolt collar. As a European, the immediate connection is SS Nazism. And Paul, our co-host here, actually pointed that out to us before we started recording earlier this week.
Yes, I didn't want to, you know, bring it up to the fandom because I thought I might have been alone. So, you know, a little validation. Thank you.
I poo-pooed on your SS.
All it needed was one more lightning bolt on either side. It was just the proper placement for it. It was awful. It was awful.
Because I was like, the show's about electricity, so they're lightning bolts. Don't make them into a Nazi.
Right, but I ran with that with you. It's like, okay, I'm good. We're over it.
And Kez says, as a European, the immediate connection is SS Nazism and rantings of a madman against the mainstream. On closer look, it's a bow tie with lightning bolts, but still unsettling, especially with the rise of right wing across Europe, imagery playing to my fears. I don't know what to make of Diane. 2 seasons of listening to every thought of Coop built up to a mythic figure. Her appearance in The Return was never going to be straightforward. She's one of my favorite characters of the new season, though, and watching the old series takes on a new life when imagining a hard-drinking and smoking Diane swearing at tapes sent by Coop. I have in my hand a small box of chocolate bunnies. Fuck you, Coop, and fuck the bunnies. Anyway, I love the podcast. It's my second favorite part of the week after the new Twin Peaks episodes. Kez. Oh,
thanks so much.
Thanks, Kez.
Yeah, so now you've kind of, you and Tina writing in talking about IMDb has swayed me away from Audrey being Richard Horn's parent. One day I will land solidly. One day, hopefully.
All right. And our final piece of feedback for tonight is from Paul N. Way. Hello, Team Sparkwood. How are you today? Hello, Team Sparkwood. How are you today? Ad nauseum. Way here. I am holding down the fort this week while my PIC, that's partner in crime, Paul, is living it up in sunny San Diego for Comic-Con.
What?
Here, oh, lucky duck.
What? Here goes my first solo attempt at feedback. Part 10 seems to be covered in red this week. We had the giant pool of blood that Miriam sustained at the hands of Richard Horn, the red coffee mug that was flung out of Becky and Steven's trailer, Janie E's shoes, the log lady's chair, the list goes on. The color red evokes so many things: passion, rage, courage, danger, fire, love. Makes me think that this is another sign that something big is about to happen, along with the log lady speech at the end, and all the various storylines will be coming to a head soon, hopefully converging in Twin Peaks. Yes, fingers crossed. There are also a lot of callbacks to the original 2 seasons this week. I think it has been mentioned in previous episodes, but there are strong parallels between the Mitchum and the Horn brothers. Mm. Both sets of brothers deal in, quote, unconventional business practices, and both have a history with arson. I am also reminded of the one-eyed Jack girls whenever I see Candy, Sandy, and Mandy, especially when they are making drinks for Rodney and Bradley. I'm not sure if this is supposed to clue us into the Mitchums' larger part in the mystery, but the similarities are hard to ignore. After Janie E. gets turned on by Dougie Coop's physique in the doctor's office, her behavior reminded me of Audrey from season 1. The close-up on her shoes mimicked the scene in Twin Peaks High School with Audrey. I even thought the way she was playing with her hair back at the house was very Audrey-esque. I have to admit, though, as nice as the view of a shirtless coop was, I felt more like a traumatized Sonny Jim after that sex scene. Just getting up in the bed like, ah, what am I hearing? What am I watching? Back in Twin Peaks, it seems that the only job that Chad could do worse than being a cop is being stealthy. Lucy was totally onto him messing around with the day's mail, which is expected to give what we know of Lucy's habit for being nosy. But when even the mailman is giving you the side eye, you know you're failing. I can't wait to see Chad get taken down, and I really hope Lucy is the one who does it.
Get the side eye from the mailman. You're a terrible, terrible person.
Yes. I know. It's like the mail is supposed to be delivered there, and you're getting the side eye from the mailman. Like, what the fuck are you doing with the mail, cop? He's just like, oh, I'll take this from you. In Vegas, I noticed that the lampshade just above Rodney's head resembles the crescent-shaped moon figure on Major Briggs' note, the one that's actually the parachute, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
okay, that's the one. Just so we're clear. Again, I'm not sure what this implies, but I thought it was curious. Also, I found the way Rodney deals with Candy after her remote control attack to be similar to how Sheriff Frank deals with Doris. Both seem incredibly tolerant with their partner's extreme emotional state. This makes me curious about Candy's story and what exactly is her relationship with the Mitchums.
That's a good point.
You know, when you watch the other girls next to Candy, they also are off in their own little aloofness, mm-hmm. too. They don't respond like other people would normally.
Yeah, they don't. It's like they're nonplussed by anything. They're just kind of like,
It's really weird.
Speaking of Candy, the scene where she asked Rodney how will he ever forgive her for what he did made me think of the image of Laura that appears before Gordon Cole later. Both Laura and Candy seem to be seeking forgiveness and assurance that they will still be loved and cared for despite what they have done or what that they are that makes them feel fear and shame. I like that.
Interesting. Yeah.
I know there are theories out there that Albert is perhaps up to no good and that Cole is really keeping a close eye on him under the guise of watching Diane. I must respectfully reject this theory. I just don't buy that someone in the throes of burgeoning love, as Albert clearly is with Coroner Constance, could think of doing wrong. Convert lives. I still contend it is likely that Cole is the one who is hiding something, as much as it pains me to think this, and I think that Laura's image appearing is a reflection of what is happening with him rather than Albert, and that Cole may be the one needing reassurances from his friends after all is revealed. On a completely different note, what the heck was Cole drawing when Albert knocked on the door, and does that rectangular device next to him look like a red version of the device we saw in Argentina that turned into a metal chip of some kind? And does anyone else see a third person between Tobias and the glass box in that photo that Tammy had of Doppelkoop in New York?
I don't know. I have to go back and look.
Yeah, you guys I'm going to have to look myself.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing that because I was focused mostly because, you know, you see Mr. C, you know who that is. You understand where the picture's taken. So you're trying to figure out, like, rack your brain to see who Tobias actually is.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I was thinking about because you were calling it a lab coat, Paul, that he was wearing. Yeah. But it's more like a trench coat and more like the trench coats we've seen on FBI agents, like Chet Desmond.
Oh, yeah.
Agent Cooper.
That's a good point.
That grayish kind of brownish grayish.
Yeah,
Lastly, the log lady. I really like your take on this being her intro into the second half of the season. As I was watching this scene, I felt like Hawk was holding back tears as he was listening to her on the phone, as if he could feel her words coming true. Even though her message sounded bleak at times, I have all the confidence the Trumans, Hawk, Cooper, and even Andy will come through and good will prevail. That's it for this week. I have to say, it's not the same doing this without Paul, but still looking forward to getting your thoughts and having my team back together next time. Your most obliged and obedient servants, Way and Paul. No, just Way this time. Just take the credit. Take the credit for this.
That's right.
Well, yeah. Way, and also last time you and Paul proved that you were our masters. In fact, the...
Yeah, we're going to have to turn around. We're the humble servants here because you guys really come with the insight and the detective work.
You'll be wrapped around my finger.
Yes.
That's the song that comes to mind. So that's because, you know, the servant becomes your master line.
I do recall that. It's the police.
Yes.
So I'm with you, too, on the whole idea. I think we all are that Albert is not up to no good. Like, we're
no.
I don't think Albert's bad.
Who said that Albert was up to no good? Is that something on the internet? Did we say that?
I speculated that because he was excluded from. I just put it as a possibility because he was indisposed. So
that's right.
He was maybe excluded for a reason. I'm not actually saying he is bad. I was just putting that out there. That's a possibility. I have seen rumblings on the internet that some people think that there's something going on with Albert from because of that earlier conversation where he had that confession to Gordon about his conversation with who he thought was a Philip Jeffries mm-hmm. that he secretly had, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's I think that's where it stemmed from. But see, he's already had a confession, so yeah. It seems like he's kind of cleared the air there and all's on the table, right?
He was indisposed because he was getting his game on with his new lady, right? And that when he dipped out when he was Gordon and them were going out to smoke.
That's probably why he was indisposed, yeah. But we didn't know why at the time.
Absolutely. But now it makes sense. So mm-hmm. he's clear. Case closed.
Because, there wouldn't have been anything for Albert to... Albert can't be shady if he's already got if he told. You don't tell somebody. I mean, I guess as a bit of misdirection, you could tell somebody 25% of the truth, and then that other 75% doesn't get looked at because they think that you've, come mm-hmm. clean. But that seems more like reality. In storytelling, you need to be clearer about what you're doing. So
I do think Wade's right to, propose that it would be more Gordon Cole who would be someone who should be under suspicion based mm-hmm. on the fact that he tries to keep people separate some of the time and not share information.
And I don't even know if that would be suspicion. All that, to me, that would just indicate that he has to compartmentalize his information giving. He has to be very, very careful about who knows what. So he's juggling that at all times because he could be on an airplane or in a car or in a room with six different people and they all have different levels of
like security clearance.
Yeah, exactly. Like different security clearances or whatever mm-hmm. the FBI equivalent is. Maybe they have those actually. And this person can know this much and that person can know that much and so on and so forth. So I think if Cole seems a little bit shisty sometimes, it's because of that. But
and then also that strange red box that he had. If it is what Wei's thinking, if it's related to the device that was in Argentina, that may mean he has other connections that are extracurricular to the FBI.
Unless we just want to go full bore into this and say that Gordon Cole is bad. That's why he has a atomic bomb going off and Garmin Bozia in his office. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to do that.
So. No, because I don't want to think that.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. with that, we will end our listener feedback podcast for Twin Peaks The Return, Part 10.
Thank you, everybody, for writing in. And once again, we will be covering Part 11 next week. It will be available to listen to on Wednesday night. We will record it on Tuesday night. And we will record our feedback podcast on Thursday night next week, just like we did today. Feedback is due Thursday, 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time at No Ship Network. Write into noshipnetwork@gmail.com if you want to participate.
All right. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
Is this thing on?